Schiff Director McDonald, DG is Otto Ntuli. Today's briefing, I'll call it a preliminary briefing because things about this issue are still happening in the NA. The matters will be transferred to us, I think, from the 20th of September. They would have finished in the NA. This bill will be coming this side. What we wanted to achieve was for members to have an insight of what is happening. You are fortunate in that we are going to have just a briefing. We can engage just a little bit. But then when it comes immediately after the 20th, that's where we'll go deep, skin deep.
Deeper than skin deep.
For us today, it should be for information so that when you do your research and so on, when it comes here, then we are well informed. There might have been an interest on this matter, so we'll introduce ourselves to the guests that are here. Normally, we know one another, even officials from the department, PMG. I'm Dumisani Gamede. I chair the Committee on Trade and International Relations. I come from KwaZulu-Natal. I'll ask everybody from my right to introduce him or herself.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Hlupheka Mtileni. I'm the committee secretary for this committee.
Aaron Nguni, committee. from the Free State.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Elsa van Lingen from the Eastern Cape.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dave Abrams from Gauteng.
Morning, everybody. Jomo Nyambi from Mpumalanga.
Morning. My name is Colin Maine from Accra.
Nick Garvey from Sabine.
Kundulam from PMC.
Zoda Ntuli, Trade and Industry Department.
McDonald Nestende, the DTI.
Can I have the honor of the guests that are present just introducing themselves? Now that's fine. Well, that's fine now. You see, now we're having a multinational meeting. All people from all over the world are here. Thanks very much. This is a select committee. We've got two houses of parliament here in South Africa. This is house is called the National Council of Provinces. We are a committee of that house. And we represent provinces. That's why you hear members saying the name of the province, where they come from. So we have the interests of the provinces. And welcome to South Africa, and we hope you have a wonderful stay when you're here in South Africa, and you also come back for Christmas. DG Ntuli, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, honourable members, and some of the people in attendance. As the Chair has indicated, today we're just doing an informal session, basically, with the committee in anticipation of the bill that we'll be bringing to this committee in a few weeks' time. And we are grateful to this particular opportunity because I think from our experience over the past 2 years, this has proven to be one of the most complex piece of amendments that we're bringing. Not because the amendments that we are bringing are complex in themselves, but I think the level of understanding in relation to intellectual property matters is really not at the level where people are able to comprehend exactly what is it that we are bringing to the table upfront. So there has been a whole lot of arguments around whether in fact this is the right route to take, and so debates have been centering around that. And I think this gives us an opportunity to really share, I think, with this committee basically where the department is coming from in terms of what we are seeking to propose to this parliament, and also what is it that we seek to achieve through that. And I think what's going to be important really is to determine whether what we want to achieve really is really coming out in the bill that we put to parliament. And I'm sure that that process will be enriched by, you know, the engagement in this committee and up until the final legislation is put to the table and subsequently implemented. I've got with me here, obviously, Mr. Nestenze, who is the chief director responsible for this area of work. And we will share with you some of the previous things that we've already done in this area. And we'll also share with you some of the challenges that obviously we're facing in regards to the proposals that we're making to this parliament. And we also will share with you what the solutions that we're proposing are, you know, subsequent to some of the engagements that we've had. And I think it is also important to indicate that we started work on this piece of work some 4 years back. So the draft, the first draft bill was in 2007. And since then, we've been engaging in consultation. We've been having expert workshops where we address specific issues that are contained in this bill. But we'll then get into that later on, Chair. But we just want to say that we really welcome this opportunity and we are grateful for the invitation. I'm going to start just by outlining the content of our presentation. It's going to be a very short presentation, but we're going to be available as long as the committee would like us for engagement, clarity, and all of that. But we just prepared our presentation to be very short and to the point so that we can have more time to engage on it. We will look at basically the rationale, and we also look at the policy objectives, and then we'll look at the legal options that we had, and then we also will look at the forms of IP just so that you can have a sense of which areas we want to be amending, because we've got various pieces of legislation in intellectual property. So we'll look at those forms of intellectual property, and then we'll then go into the areas specifically which we are seeking to effect amendments to in the various pieces, and then some of the recommendations that we are making. So it's going to be, like I said, very brief, but then we will be here to engage fully on it as the committee wishes. Okay, I think the first question really would be, why do we even want to interfere with the intellectual property side of things to deal with indigenous knowledge? If you recall, the bill that we have presented to the parliament deals with amending intellectual property laws in order to protect indigenous knowledge. And a lot of people have asked, why do we even want to do that? I think the first thing that we want to say is that when you talk about indigenous knowledge or we talk about traditional knowledge, everybody knows that, and everybody knows that it exists. And it is being utilized in the intellectual property arena. But it is not recognized fully in that space. But it is the very same space where you find that knowledge of community members that have been innovative around certain practices that are actually achieving certain goals for the communities, but also that could have a potential to sustain those communities if commercialized properly. What you find is that that kind of knowledge is taken by other people and then exploited commercially to the disadvantage of communities. And that is happening purely because traditional knowledge, it has not been brought into the mainstream. where it enjoys full protection. When people think about traditional knowledge, they think about something that is like a bit primitive, a bit useless, but then it doesn't become useless when they make money out of it. So what we find over the years is that the traditional knowledge or indigenous knowledge in South Africa has been exploited largely externally out of this country, where people come in, researchers come in, they talk to communities, they uncover certain things, they uncover a whole lot of practices that could advance certain business imperatives. And they would take that and then they would commercialize it, they would patent it, or they'll copyright it if it's a song, and so forth. And then they'll benefit from it. But the communities who originated that would not benefit anything. So the area of intellectual property basically protects the creative mind of an individual. And that's what this is all about. But what we find is that our intellectual property laws have not extended far enough to protect traditional knowledge. So we've looked at various options, obviously. And there are a number of options that a country can adopt to protect intellectual indigenous knowledge. And in this country, a policy was developed and was approved by cabinet to say that South Africa is going to take a particular approach. And that approach is the approach that we want to share with this committee, which is the approach that then brings us to this committee. The rationale for regulating indigenous knowledge cannot be overemphasized, because I think the estimation of the traditional knowledge, the value of it that is lost, you know, for the communities is estimated around, I think it's 180 million per annum, what is being lost by traditional communities due to misappropriation by people that do not own information, and people that do not even pay royalties to those communities, people that don't even acknowledge, even if it's a book that is written based on traditional information, there's not even an acknowledgement that says this information has been taken from this particular community. So I think those are the things that we're talking about. That at the end of the day, you'll find that communities don't even want to have money, but they would prefer acknowledgement. So that you acknowledge that that right is not actually yours. You didn't create that. You took it from a particular community and you used it in your book or in your song or in your medicine, whatever the case may be. So that's all they might want. But at the end of the day, we don't want to afford protection only for acknowledgement. We want to afford protection to ensure that they're able to actually be entitled to a right that they've created, and also be in a position to commercialize it, be in a position to license other people to use it, so that the community can benefit from the creative thinking that the community generates over the years. So that's basically why we're here. If you look at the loss estimated at 180 million per annum, that talks about something, that knowledge that we know about, I guess. There's a whole lot of knowledge that we don't even know about, which is being commercialized in various countries. And a lot of people are making a lot of money, especially multinationals. And so we think that there's a need to protect and there's a need to regulate it. And we need to just incorporate and make amendments to various areas which are relevant to deal with the aspect of indigenous knowledge. Chair, we've also said previously that the protection of indigenous knowledge through the intellectual property system is not an end in itself. It is going to be a method that will complement other methods, because we've got other avenues around preservation, like your heritage sites and all of that. That is also a form of protection. But then what you want is to also deal with the part that deals with commercialization, so that you can complement and offer full protection to indigenous knowledge. So it will not be an end in itself if you amend the intellectual property laws. You still have to look at the other various pieces of legislation which are in existence in the area of art and culture, in the area of the laws, I think that are administered by science and technology. You need to look at the biodiversity issues and all and so forth to see if actually you've covered all the ground, because intellectual property will not address some of those issues around preservation and safeguarding the interests of communities. So it is not an end in itself. So we want that to be understood, that it is part of a package of solutions that are put on the table. And Chair, in looking at that, the one thing that we said is that we need to take into account the needs of the indigenous communities, because in as much as we want to afford protection, it will not be, I think, worth our while if we think what the community wants. We need to be in a position to take into account what their interests are. And for an example, one of the things that obviously has come up several times is that if you look at certain traditional practices, if you put them in the intellectual property arena, they might have to be disclosed to the public. So the question would be, what kind of protection do you give to those people that don't necessarily want to disclose but want to protect their right, but they don't want their right to be in the public domain, in the public eye? So we also will be looking in the bill into some areas that are actually looking at protecting that. But also people can use like trade secrets to actually protect their rights. They don't necessarily have to disclose. So that also then says that you need to afford a right or a protection that is conducive to the person that you want to protect. So we need to take into account the interests of the communities. And also in looking at the interests of the communities, we look at the mostly rural communities. What role do traditional structures play in there? How do you bring the traditional structures into the structures that you have in the intellectual property arena, so that you also do not create processes that are contradictory or processes that do not talk to each other. So I think it is important for us to take into account significantly the interests of the community, so that whatever solution we're putting on the ground is the solution that will address their needs as well. Chair, we've got a few policy objectives that we seek to achieve, obviously, in this bill. One of them, obviously, the first being to ensure that we provide a legal framework to protect indigenous knowledge, but also to empower communities to be in a position to commercialize and trade in indigenous knowledge. And also we want to bring indigenous knowledge holders into the mainstream of the economy. I think this point, Chair, I've indicated that the fact that it is not recognized anywhere openly in our laws, it makes it to be somewhere in the background. So it's really humming in the background, but other people make it sing when they really want to make money. So it's somewhere there. So what you want to ensure is that when you afford legal framework for it, then you bring it into the mainstream. And then you can be in a position to even assess its contribution to the economy, because at this point you do not even know what contribution it is. We can only estimate based on what we know and what we've seen has come forth. But whatever we've seen has been coming forward has been through exploitation, where people would go and fight cases. Then we realize that, okay, the Hoodia plant and then the rooibos, then those are the ones that we can estimate. But the ones that we don't know about, we cannot even say what the value of it is. So if we create a proper legal framework, then we're able to actually bring everything onto the fore. And then we're able to measure, we're able to actually even assess whether there's any impact onto the economy and what kind of impact it makes. And also we just need to ensure that we conserve the environment. I think in this case, what we think, and I think a lot of research has shown as well, that if you do promote the use of traditional methods, you will be in a position to also encourage people to focus more on traditional farming and move more to organic, and all of those things would actually go a long way in preserving the environment and ensuring that people take some of the traditional methods seriously, and that they can actually generate some revenue and income from that, and that communities can actually sustain themselves through that. So we think that as an objective is one thing that we can be in a position to measure over a period of time. And the last part really, which is, I think, is important for all of us, is really that the framework that we need to put in place needs to achieve prevention of misappropriation of biopiracy and exploitation of these rights without compensation. So we need to prevent a situation where people basically steal from the rightful owners of this knowledge. So So those are the objectives that I've just covered. And the slides that I'm on right now just basically talks about the legal options. When we do, obviously, we look at whether there's a need for us to regulate or not. We look at the policy objects or options that are available to us. So if you look at indigenous knowledge, you look at it purely, it is unprotected at this point. And even though we try to invoke various provisions to try and extend protection to it, but it is just not there. So what we then looked at was, what are the options that are available to us to deal with this issue? And the options that we then came out with was, firstly, to amend the existing intellectual property laws to cater for it, because I think the basic issue is that indigenous knowledge is knowledge that is capable of protection. About that, Chair. And so that is the option that we had. And like we've said, it is not going to offer full protection. It will still mean that other people have got to do certain things to protect indigenous knowledge in the area of arts, culture, and so forth. And the second option also that was available is to look at the sui generis legislation. Sui generis legislation basically means that you develop a piece of legislation that is unique in a nature that will deal purely with indigenous knowledge. And that could be, maybe we could have Indigenous Knowledge Act that will then deal with how we protect it, how we basically preserve and so forth. So that kind of an option was also explored. And also in terms of just the international debate at WIPO, these are the options that have been talked about. And obviously the other option, which is no option, is not to do anything about it. So the options that are available to us are these options. So in 2004, Cabinet adopted a policy on indigenous knowledge. And in that policy, it was decided that South Africa will use a combination of this so that it can offer full protection. A combination of this means that we will amend the intellectual property laws, because that is the avenue through which you need to commercialize, and that's the avenue through which, at this point, indigenous knowledge is being misappropriated. And then also, the policy is that the various departments like agriculture, in arts and culture, science and technology, should come up with special pieces of legislation to deal with the issues of preservation, issues of safeguarding, and so forth. So it's a combination of all of this that these countries adopted to take in protecting IKS, because it was agreed and was considered that intellectual property as an avenue on its own will not afford full protection. But as we go through some of the interventions that we've put in place, you'll realize some of the difficulties, obviously, that we faced, and the difficulties that actually confirms why we need a combination of all of this. So it basically just confirms that the policy that has been adopted by this country is actually the right policy. And if you look internationally, that's basically what is happening. A number of countries like the US, Brazil, they've amended their intellectual property laws in various areas to protect indigenous knowledge. And I think as a country, we need to also ensure that we move fast to do that, so that we avoid the misappropriation that is continuing. I'm going to hand over to McDonald to just take you through some of the forms of IP briefly, and then we can just get into the bill itself in terms of the interventions that we are bringing in the bill, so that you can have a sense of what is it that we want to deal with in those little pieces of legislation that we have. Thanks.
No, thanks, Chair and Honorable Members and the other guests. I'm going to talk about the forms of intellectual property. What is intellectual property? In short, is the work of the mind. So probably when we say we want protection of indigenous knowledge, IK, we want to protect the work of the mind. There is also the work of the mind in indigenous knowledge. I think that is the argument. So one form of intellectual property is a patent. A patent is something like what medicines, the drugs that we drink for our ailments, and then its lifespan is 20 years. So some people will say, I don't want to disclose my traditional knowledge, it is perpetual. So therefore, I don't want to come into the system of patents. So this bill is not going to force any person to disclose, but it's a choice that you can, because the moment you don't come into the system, some people come and talk to you, and then you give the information, and then they steal your knowledge. An example is the Nestle recently, there was a case of Nestle. Nestle, Switzerland, the mother, the country, is a signatory to some international treaties that whatever happens, you should disclose the country of origin of the material that you use. So they never revealed, yes, South Africa is an example, but through some registration process, it was found that they found the genetic resources here in South Africa, and they work with the community in Alice in the Eastern Cape. So there was no benefit benefit sharing agreement. So therefore, you may choose not to reveal, but people can come and poach. I think that is the rationale of the patents can be used to protect traditional knowledge, but for a limited lifespan. The other issue is that the Patents Act, we are not dealing with the Patents Act here. We have amended it, as the DDG said, in 2005. Why? Because the Biodiversity Act that deals with genetic resources was being amended. So, in order to complement each other, these two departments, or one government speaking in one voice, we said there are people who go and steal genetic resources or get a patent on genetic resources and go to the intellectual property office and register. So, therefore, the registrar should not allow a patent to be granted if certain conditions are not met. That is one. There should be a disclosure of the genetic resources, like the Nestle case. It should not have happened. Secondly, there should be a prior informed consent with that particular community you are working with. There should be a disclosure of indigenous knowledge as well as the community. Again, lastly, there must be a benefit-sharing agreement so that the community will also get something, so that when that example of Nestle, they get billions, a portion also should go to the community. I think that is the rationale. So we have already dealt with the issue of prior informed consent in the patent amendment. So now we are just extending the same principles to the other domains of intellectual property. Another domain of intellectual property is a trademark. A trademark is like what Coke, Coca-Cola, Benz, BMW. I'm just giving an example of a trademark. What is ShopRite in the retail sector? There are many examples of trademarks. So the purpose of a trademark generally is to distinguish goods. This good should be different from this one. So that is the purpose of a trademark. So a good example of another trademark, which you will know, in the area of collective trademark or certification trademark, it may be rooibos. Rooibos is a tea in South Africa. You know that we had a case of rooibos. One South African went to the U.S. because he used to advise the rooibos community. She learned that the U.S. is one of the biggest consumer of rooibos, so followed by Germany. By then, statistics might have changed. So she advised them. Later, she went to the U.S. She said, South African is not a U.S. national. I know that there is a U.S. national here. So she went there, she trademarked the name Rooibos. what does it mean? Intellectual property gives you the monopoly around the name or whatever. So therefore, they could no longer enter into the U.S. market. And what happened is that he said, you enter under my terms, pay me a royalty. But we gave money to that community, Glenn William, whatever, to fight that case, and the U.S. deregistered the name. It was deregistered. Why? Because we were losing a market of these indigenous people. We spent probably $1 million to defend, to fight that case, and then I've forgotten the statistic, but the money that we lost, we spend, is very meager, very small, compared to the revenue which was coming to the particular community. So that is the rooibos story. The honeybush is another issue in Japan. It is registered, but the Japanese are not the fighting type. So we'll deal with that one. Another issue is in the wine industry. We talk about geographical indicator. I will explain what is a geographical indicator, but I'm still in the trademark certification mark. Maybe in the wines you see something certified, and then there is a number. So it shows that there is a body that says if you meet this criteria, therefore you can claim that your wine taste is peculiar to this type. Say French Hook as an example. You cannot say made in French Hook, whereas it is from Stellenbosch, because the soil, the climate is not the same, as an example. So this issue of trademark and geographical indication as a collective, it is practiced internationally, including South Africa. You know about our wines. We are probably number not beyond five. So this is a trademark which can also be a geographical indicator. So another issue is the government can declare a geographical indicator unilaterally to say this is our geographical indicator. The agriculture department can do that, the trade, the DTI can also do that. And associations generally are formed to regulate themselves in the area of geographical indicators. Let me explain what is a geographical indicator before I lose you. A geographical indicator, it means that it's an indicator that is related to a geographic area. Rooibos, as an example, it is in South Africa. It cannot be grown in the mainland or in the Western Cape, larger cities, but it is in Glen William area. So it cannot be grown anywhere. The U.S. Tried to grow it organically. It is refusing because it allows to be grown there. So therefore, we can declare it to be a geographical indicator, and then go to our trading partners, and then can you recognize this one in so much that we have exclusive right in South Africa, and then the revenue when they consume it comes here. So how many geographical indicators, as the DDG said, we are not so certain. I talk about rooibos as well as honeybush. Some other people are coming with garwolem, but some are coming with Garo chicken, Garo street. So it will dilute if it is not true that Garo lamb is peculiar to that area. And then you come with chicken, but it is misleading. So let me talk about the U.S. as my DDG said. To say that the U.S. has got a law which says don't do anything if it does not come from the Indian, red Indian area. Don't say made for the Indians, whereas it is not coming from that area. So you are misleading the consumer. So it's the same principles here. One of the functions of the intellectual property is not to mislead the consumer. So we also have a design. The design, there are two types of design, aesthetic as well as functional. The other one is 15 years aesthetic, the other one functional is 10 years. A good example of a functional is like a wheelbarrow. that is a design, you design a wheelbarrow. But somebody can come with something akin, looking like a wheelbarrow, but not real wheelbarrow. So therefore, because of the function, you can do that. There is a fashion design in South Africa, so the shape of a bottle is a design. I may want to drink this water more than this one because of the design of the cup or of the glass. So we are saying, as there are no traditional designs, so let me talk about Ndebele design as an example. It is being pushed and put somewhere, and then people claim that it is beautiful, and maybe it's 90% Ndebele. I'm just exaggerating, and a small portion something, but then the Ndebeles are not getting something. That's what we want to stop. I see somebody is nodding. It means that things are going. Copyright is what it's like. Music, as an example, the dancing. So we are saying we can also use copyright to protect the issue of music, traditional music. We have a case here in South Africa, Mbube. Mbube was owned by two people. The other one migrated to overseas, and then internationally was claiming the royalties as if he was the author, at the expense of the author who remained here in South Africa. So a problem started. But to go deeper, Mbube should not have been authored by those two individuals only. They should have appreciated people who came with Mbube. Probably the Zulus will talk about Mbube as an example. So there are also copyright issues. There are designs related to tradition. So coming to the provisions of the bill generally, it covers all the domains, as I was talking. I mean, in summary, it has to you have to a derivative, as an example. A derivative intellectual property means in design, you will have to go to that design of the Ndebele, which is not protected as for now. And then you scramble something, you come with a new thing, as long as in the copyright it qualifies to be original, because copyright says it must be original. So if it qualifies, then we say it's a derivative copyright, and therefore we are saying go and work with that community where you got whatever music we're talking about, and therefore have a prior consent, disclose that you work with this community, have a benefit sharing, and commercialize that. The lifespan of a copyright is my lifespan plus 50 years. Countries like the US now are going to 70, 75. So it's a policy issue. Maybe one day we may say it's a lifespan of McDonald's plus 200 years. I'm just exaggerating. So it's a policy matter. So, however, on that raw folk law, we are saying you cannot claim that it is yours, raw as it is. It should be claimed by the community. There was no protection. The fact that there was no protection, it doesn't mean that it was in the public domain. Now, according to this bill, we are reclaiming it to say no intellectual property should be claimed from raw Ndebele design, as an example, without consent of the particular Ndebele clan, whatever. That, I think that's what the bill is saying. So we can argue in trademarks, is the same thing. We can argue in design, copyright, and then in patents, we have already done that. I think generally that's what we are saying. And then the lifespan of that Ndebele design, raw as it is perpetual. So it is perpetual. However, of the derivative, it will be if it is a design, functional or aesthetic, as I described, 15 or 10 years. If it's a trademark, it will be 10 years, but the law of trademark allows you to renew. After 10 years, you renew again. So it can is perpetual. Geographical indicator, sorry, the lifespan is perpetual. So therefore, the IP system can be used to protect this issue of indigenous knowledge. Another issue is sort of a database. There are people who don't want to reveal to the public that I'm using this one belongs to me, like Coke. Coke never patented what we are drinking. They use trade secrets, like our traditional healers. So for this purpose, please, from today onwards, look at the protection of Coke as a traditional healer. He or she does not want to reveal. However, you can go to the intellectual property office and say, I'm giving it to you, this thing, under confidence, in confidence. Confidentiality, the law of confidentiality is allowed to protect, say, Coke, secret, trade secret. It's for you, the officials only. But so that when somebody comes in to say, I have this 1, 2, 3, they should immediately see that it belongs to McDonald's. But don't reveal to people outside. So we are using the law of data protection, which is allowed in intellectual property. Another issue is that we should encourage this community to have vehicles like a trust, as an example. They can form a company, they can form a cooperative. And again, we should be able to recognize their structure, the structures that exist in the community. In the law of intellectual property or trademark, if Coke gets something, the board of Coke, the governance of Coke, says the CEO, as an example, go and register, but under the mandate of Coke. So a natural person can register a trademark, or you must have a mandate from the institution you come from. So what is the difference if a tribal area, they have got their own system of a structure, and then to say the structure give a mandate for a design to be registered, nothing different. So that's what the bill also talks about. And then there is also dispute resolution. It is very expensive to defend these things I'm talking about. You need a senior counsel to go to court. So therefore, if we introduce this bill, and then we are looking at this communities we are talking about, to go to court for them is a dream. So we introduce another alternative dispute resolution, a cheaper one. They should sit under the tree and resolve their problem. If somebody wants something, go under that tree. They are not boardrooms like this, and then you talk. And then if there is a dispute, alternative number one, there is no lawyer allowed to appear there. It's not in the labor area, like CCMA, lawyers at a preliminary stage are not allowed. And then, but we're not saying we're taking away the powers of court. We're saying exhaust certain things informally or formally, and then agreement can be made in order of court. If you are not happy, then you can go to a court, as goes the legend. So generally, we are saying we are not excluding the powers of courts here. I'm on page 9. The other issue maybe on page 9 is licensing of IP rights in all IP laws. We are saying there should be an issue of not deed of assignment, just selling your rights without knowing. They give you 10,000. But they get billions and billions. So license it, and you get a royalty. So therefore, we are introducing the issue of licensing and royalty. That is the benefit sharing. So then the royalty can be negotiated. If there is a dispute, the same process. But generally, you can also go to court, but I don't foresee a situation where people will impose. So before I conclude, I think on page 10, courts can enforce the rights as well as long as you followed that fair and efficient, speedy manner, instead of residing in court for 2 years waiting for the dispute to be finalized. So what we are saying is that the conclusion of penalties generally is that in the Patents Act there is this issue of saying if you don't disclose, like Nestle as an example, if we don't disclose and we find out, therefore we revoke the patent, we cancel the patent because you committed fraud. I think it's fraud. You misled. Yeah, it's fraud. So in conclusion, we are saying there are countries. We are not the only countries who are doing this, but there is not an international agreement. Intellectual property generally, it is administered at the World Intellectual Property Organization, and then it is also in the World Trade Organization. There is an agreement, we call it TRIPS Agreement. Don't mind about the acronym. So, however, protection of indigenous knowledge, there is no international treaty. So it's a national prerogative. And then internationally, WIPO established the committee to deal with this issue. There is a vast material that we can use in order to improve on the country. But before this issue of an international treaty comes into being, it's better to use the same system which is exploiting people. So some people will say, go to use a sui generis as described by the DDG. But if you have your sui generis like a Heritage Act, Cultural Act, stand alone, not talking to intellectual property, somebody, for argument's sake, can go and take, say, what an example, I've been using the Bele, let me be consistent, and the Bele thing from heritage perspective, and because it's not connected to the IP system, that person can come and get an intellectual property based on the Bele design, as an example. So therefore, we are saying other departments will have to do their peace in heritage, biodiversity, as they have already done. But as one government, we must talk in one voice. Generally, DDG, I think I'm done. Thanks.
So, we have come to the conclusion of our presentation. And obviously, just to summarize really what we were putting on the table is that the bill that we have proposed to Parliament seeks to amend the Copyright Act, the Designs Act, the Trademarks Act, and the Performance Protection Act. And we've already indicated that in 2005, we've already amended the Patents Act. And I think the reason why we actually accelerated that one was because of the need at the time and the urgency around it in the area of biodiversity, when we then worked with the Department of Environmental Affairs at the time to deal with the Biodiversity Act. And so we had to make those amendments at the same time to try and complement the two systems as per their policy. And the principles really that we are putting into the four pieces that we are amending really is the principle of saying that when you utilize indigenous knowledge in any of these areas, you need to ensure that you disclose where you've taken that from, and also to show the registrar that you have received consent from that particular community or that particular area to utilize that particular information or knowledge. And the third thing being the benefit-sharing arrangement. And the benefit-sharing arrangement could actually be in relation to agreeing in terms of how you're going to pay royalties to them or how you're going to co-own what is going to be registered, whether it's a patent or sorry, a trademark or a copyright, but how you're going to actually benefit the very same community. So it could dictate a whole lot of issues. And so those are the principles really that we're bringing across into the various pieces. And the things that we want this committee to also just keep in mind as you're looking at the bill in front of you is the concerns that were raised initially but that have since been addressed. The first question was really largely around how are you going to identify the community, you know, the beneficiaries. Because the question was, if I want to use the, for instance, McDonald was using the Ndebele design, if I want to use that, how will I know who are the owners of that? All right. So that was the issue that was being raised. But that issue can be addressed because in any event, if you find a book or a paper written without an author and you'd like to use it in your own book, even if you don't know who the owner is, you can do, I think the law requires you to do a diligent search. If you fail to get who the owner is, you still can't claim that it is yours. You will acknowledge it. You can even write in your book owner, author unknown, to show that it's not yours. So it distinguishes between saying you can't find somebody, because you can't find somebody, you claim it's yours. You can't claim it's yours. You need to say, I don't know who the owner is, but I want to use it, so that then at least you've disclosed that part. So I think that is something that can be done. I'm just giving that as an example, that it is not an excuse to say, how will I know which community it is? You are required by law in any event to do a proper search, a diligent search, and then you can then come and say, I cannot find the owner, but I want to register this as a trademark. And when you register it as a trademark, obviously, then you'll disclaim that part that is not yours. So that is the, this is not different. It's the same approach that we are taking in this case. So, and one of the things that also will assist in identifying the owners of various traditional knowledge is the use of databases where people can register so that on the databases we can do a search and see if this is part of knowledge that already existed and that is owned by a particular community. So the database issue will advance that part, I think, significantly. But also the role of traditional structures will also assist in identifying the origin or at least the owners of particular knowledge. And then the second aspect that we want the committee to also ponder on is the issue around the lifespan. The concern has been that because indigenous knowledge by nature, you know, a lot of people want it to be protected perpetually. So if it comes into the IP domain, then it might have limitations because trademark is 10 years, copyright is 50 years after the death of the author and so forth and so forth. Will this not actually limit or reduce the rights of the community? So we're saying that, in fact, that's not the case because if you look at it, intellectual property in the area of trademarks, for instance, is perpetual. In the area of GIs, is perpetual. So it is not that. But also, even in the area where there's a limitation, let's say copyright 50 years after the lifespan of the person, if it's indigenous knowledge, provisions can be made for it to revert back to the community. If the person that had registered that right dies. So a lot of options have been put on the table to deal with particular aspects. And we've also requested the various experts to advise on this issue. So there's a whole lot of solutions that are already on the table to deal with that. And then the third aspect is really the issue of the confidentiality of the database. We've already addressed that. The database will have various levels of confidentiality. So if you don't want your knowledge to be open to the public, but you want it to be recorded, so that when you want to exercise your right to fight it, when somebody uses it somewhere, you don't have to start by establishing the right, but then you can use the database as a basis to say, I'm actually the owner, I've registered it, and then you can then start fighting for whatever it is, whether it's a royalty or and so forth. And then the last part really was that because indigenous knowledge owners are likely to be people that are in rural communities that might not have formal education, do we expect them to then exercise these rights that we are giving to them through the same redress mechanism that we have? Remember that in IP law, it is your right. If you register the trademark, it's up to you to protect it. The state can protect you to a certain level, but it cannot really give you full protection in terms of enforcing it. If somebody steals your trademark and uses it somewhere, you need to go to court to fight that person. So the question was whether, in fact, we want to subject the indigenous communities to that kind. And I think that mechanism of alternative dispute resolution was then put into the picture to deal particularly with the vulnerable nature of the people that will be holding this right, to say that we need to create structures where they don't have to go to court to fight their rights. But in addition to that, we've also enhanced the enforcement powers of the commission that will then administer this act to actually be in a position to investigate, you know, on behalf of communities if there are complaints that are being lodged against the misappropriation and so forth. So those really are the issues that were raised lastly. And finally, you'll hear a lot of issues around sui generis, and also that WIPO is in favor of sui generis and so forth and all of that. We are at a point right now that internationally we do not expect that there will be a breakthrough on this issue in the next 5 years. There was a deadlock for 9 years, which we subsequently sort of tried to break somehow. But then this issue has been in discussion forever because there is a difference of opinion and approach between the developing countries and the developed countries. And so we do not anticipate that there will be an international treaty very soon. So this issue will continue to be an issue of discussion. But nationally, we need to be in a position to come up with legislation that does not contravene or contradict any of the treaties that we've already signed. And in this case, this one does not contradict any of the treaties. So we are in the right approach. And I think we will set an example for a whole lot of other countries with this piece of legislation, Chair. I think that's all that I wanted to say, Chair, and then we'll be here to really deal with questions. Thanks.
Thanks to the department. I ask one member to introduce himself.
Thank you, Chair. First, apologies for being late. I just caught up in another meeting. My name is Freddie Adams, a representative of the Western Cape. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Honorable Adams. Honorable Adams is also a chair of economic development. It also deals with mining and energy. Honorable members, you heard this is just to excite your taste buds about what is to come. Some points of clarity. Normally I don't ask the first question, but DDG, are you satisfied with the taking of the bill, looking into different parts of the country, looking at the Ndebele people and the Zulu people, and all those people, just as a general comment, but all members will also ask questions of clarity. Honorable Abrams, Honorable Nyambi.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I've just got one question. It was very interesting, and I think it is correct that, you know, we should take care of the issues like that. But what education program do you have in the pipeline to educate these vast communities, especially the rural areas, you know, to take care and protect them? Thank you.
Nyambi?
Thanks, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation that has been done this morning. I think this is what is long overdue. But my first question is in relation to the procedure. What are the implications of us as a select committee in the NCOP, even though it's good for us to have this privileged information before it has been presented to the NA dealing with it now? What impact are we going to make in terms of discussion, because they still have to go to that house? That's the first one. The second one is about the issue of the traditional, the House of Traditional Leaders. It said that the state law advisors are of the view that there won't be that need to take it to the House of the Traditional Leaders. Maybe a little bit of elaboration, the motive behind that. Then the third one, it's about the very same state law advisors, because it said that it has been prescribed as Section 75 in terms of the Constitution. Even in that one, I would like to understand the motive behind that. But the last question, it said that the regulatory impact assessment report of the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Bill, if you check it, you can see that the benefits are likely greater than the cost. But if you go back to look at what is going to be done, you will see that you have to have the remuneration of members of the council, a lot of things have to be done. So a little bit of elaboration in that statement in relation to what I've said, that is linked to what is supposed to be done in relation to the bill. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. To me, the question revolves basically around two areas of clarity, maybe three. You mentioned all the different acts that are being amended and addressed, but is this linked to NEMA? Because we've got lots of plant species that are indigenous to specific areas and that are being used for specific medicines. And in your statement there, you say you conserve the environment, but to what extent are we protecting our plant species? Then we in South Africa, it's not everybody that can go through an agreement or a contract with a fine-tooth comb and sit and think where the attorney is going to swindle you out of your rights. And I'm not saying our indigenous people are illiterate, if you understand what I mean. You can buy a house today and buy it footstools, but still have a leaking roof falling on your head, which the owner knew about. So how are our people going to be protected in as much as those agreements can still be to their detriment rather than to their benefit? And then it carries on, because you talk about dispute resolutions under the tree. But let me first do the database thing. The database must have obviously an IT backup. And how secure is that going to be? Because we know what went wrong with the CIPRO situation. So from what I understand, there's going to be different levels of confidentiality. So you're going to grade it like drugs, a level 5 drug or a whatever. But I also need a little bit of clarity on the database versus the licensing. Is it going to be the same thing? The cost of the database, is there going to be a proper backup system for it? Because backup systems, things like that, can be quite expensive. And then the royalties, again, how is that going to be determined? Is it a standard principle, or is it going to be negotiated every time? And you know what? Very often you go into business with a closed corporation or a company, and then that one folds, and you carry on with the same thing in another one. But you buy over the whatever. So I'm really concerned about that. And how will the royalties be documented, in the database or in the license? Or both? if it's not the same thing. Thank you, Chairperson. And I'm supposed to present the apology of Honourable Sinclair, who cannot attend to this meeting. Of course. He cannot cope, so he can't cope to be here.
Well, he knows the procedure, you know, that he shouldn't SMS you. DDG, this question has been asked, but I'll ask it differently. How do you deal with traditional knowledge without involving traditional leaders? So you can respond to all the questions.
Thanks. Let me deal with the issue of royalty. I'm just choosing it. The royalties, in terms of the bill, parties should first agree or attempt to agree, negotiate. There is no standardized agreement to say this is a template, as an example. But maybe jurisprudence, as time goes on, there can be such, but at a point of entry, we don't have such. There is a body that is established in terms of the bill, that is the National Council. One of its functions is also to assist the indigent, the communities, because these are experts in various areas of intellectual property or indigenous knowledge, to assist, including in the licensing, to say, is it a fair agreement? So that structure will greatly assist, but we don't have a standardized one. So going to that issue of saying we are dealing with the powerful, and then we're dealing with the weak, the vulnerable one. When it goes to that national council, I think they will pick it up to say this is not a good agreement. Can we renegotiate or follow up, review it? And this is the structure that will assist. We forgot to talk about a collecting society. A collecting society is a body that represents, in particular now, currently we have collecting society that represents the performers, the musician. So you find that collecting societies assign or license other people who are using music. Like here in Parliament, if there was a music here, you could have by now found that a collecting society is saying, give us how many CDs are you playing? Whose CD are you playing? So pay so much royalties in the hotels and the like. So they negotiate those agreements, as an example. So that trust which we mentioned, or the together with the collecting societies, are also powerful organizations that can also assist the indigent to really to empower themselves in negotiations. Let me also deal with the issue of the database in relation with licensing, because they are related. These collecting societies generally, they have got databases of their own. There are many databases in South Africa of their own, where they can see that you want to get permission to play, to be licensed on 123. So they can go into their databases. So because our databases are so fractured, this database that we're talking about is at the commission. It used to be CIPRO then, at the commission. It can also assist to say, okay, I understand there is clan A or B and B that owns 123. That is the diligent search that the DDG was referring to. It can assist you to identify the owner of that intellectual property, and then you go into negotiation. So the licensing part of it, say in the law of trademarks, when Coke licensed somebody there is a recorder that is done in South Africa. Coke may not be functioning here itself. It might have franchise and the like, but you need to record at SIP, at a commission, to say this trademark of mine is being used by so and so. That is the licensing agreement, franchising, it may be a licensing proper. So that database can also assist in giving you the fair understanding of who owns what. So that is the issue of database. The security part of it, yes, it is true. It needs to be guarded. Like Coke, I understand that there are many people who are guarding the database of Coke, as an example, because of that trade secret. So even here, the security part of it, whether it's IT and the like, it should be in place. I know that you were talking about the hijacking of companies and the like, to say confidential information, is it not going to be pliable to be stolen? By any means, we need really to operate in a secure environment. System should be in place. The cost part of it, we said there are benefits more than costs. Yes, we try to calculate the payment of for those members and the like. It's a sizable amount, but the issue is that 180 million that the DDG talked about, that we're losing 180 million. I don't know how we calculated this one on the rear report, but you may see that it is maybe 500,000, I'm just saying, in so much that therefore, when we go to the music, the designs and the like, we are convinced that the benefit will outweigh the putting of the system, say, of this database. This database, by the way, it will be in the intellectual property office per se. There will be other databases in the environmental affairs and the like, but we are convinced that the benefits will be more. I need to be finished with this MIMA Act, but I'm just saying that it may be in the genetic resources, it may be in agriculture. So the genetic resources, we talk about the biodiversity, bioprospecting and the like, they do protect that. But we're saying the moment you want to claim a patent, the Patents Act will say, reveal you were working with so and so, where is the benefit agreement, as an example. But in the plant, there is also Plant Varieties Act under the Agriculture Department. That also needs to be realigned with this issue, to say there is also genetic or traditional knowledge in the Agriculture Department. So if there is that realignment, I think your fear will be covered. But let me confess that I'm not an expert in this area, but I'm just talking about genetic resources. If they are in agriculture, they can be protected. If they are environmental affairs, they can be protected. If they need to be in line with the patents regime, therefore, this is the scheme which we have put in place. But there can be a follow-up if I didn't talk to it deeply. In passing, there is this issue of what is the impact. I don't know, I will confer with my DDG whether it is for us or not, but we it seems as if it is not ours. What will be the impact, because the other house is still busy with that, and then no, it's confirmed it's not for us. Then the issue, royalties again. We are not talking about royalty money issue only. There can be a royalty or a benefit sharing agreement in various stages. You can say, I will give you money, lump sum of so much, if so much is found. A good example was the Woodya plant, you know, the Okoye and the Sons people had a patent, something patented by the CSIR, and then it was licensed overseas and the like. To cut the story short, the agreement says, should you commercialize this patent from the Hoodia plant and then you get so much, give the community 8 million, if I'm not mistaken. The other says, give them, say, 12 million, as goes the legend. It's like the AIDS drug, as an example. Patent as it is, it does not have a value per se. But the moment, say, there is a pandemic like AIDS, HIV, then that drug can go up in so much that it may be trillions. So therefore, if you didn't negotiate the payment of the royalty well, to say I want 1%, you are the loser. Maybe sometimes it's to say, oh, South Africa has got this pandemic, these are the drugs which comes from this traditional knowledge, and therefore in 2014, this drug will go up, so therefore give me so much. These are negotiating skills which is not part of this act, but that education and awareness issue to say, guys, organize yourself around like unions, like collecting societies in order to empower yourself so that you negotiate these royalties well. And they can say, we want to build a school for you, not to give you money because you don't have a school. We want to build a clinic. That can also be part of and parcel of the benefit sharing agreement, as an example. So the difficult part, the education awareness program, I think I talked to it to say it needs to be put in place in order to empower them to know how to differentiate the stages when the intellectual property goes up, because it depends on the market. You may be dealing in copyright music. You may find that it is taking number one in the US, as an example, for 50 weeks. But when you started to negotiate, you never thought that it will go so up. You just say, give me 1%. Yeah, so I'm trying to talk to the issue of empowering community through awareness and education under the Companies Act, which also covered intellectual property, that we came here to this honorable committee. There is the issue of the duty of the Commission for Education and Awareness as one of number one issue to go to the public, to educate the public. So this issue will be covered there. The tagging part of it is the Section 75 issue. We were advised, probably correctly, to say we need this, there is this competency is national. In so much that therefore we may not need to go to the House of Traditional Leaders. And then the constitutionality part of it, I think it was ironed out, but we consulted with all organizations related to the chiefs, if I may say so, contralesers and the like. We dealt with them, but the question is the House of Traditional Leaders, whether it should go. And then the procedure, I've already said, no, does not belong to us. No need to go to traditional leaders, elaborate. I think I have talked to it very thinly, but the DDG may also talk to some of the issues. So, Chair DDG, I'm done. Chair, thank you. But the DDG will like to say something on whatever I said. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Obviously a number of questions, and we're trying to address all of this, but like we said, these are actually questions that were raised with us before. We actually go into detail when we come to this committee. then we'll be able to put some of these things into proper perspective. But I just want to say that in relation to the issue of database and its security and so forth, yes, we have had issues with the company register where there's hijackings and so forth, but I think the committee would agree that we haven't had anything of related to security or lack thereof in relation to our IP register. Our IP register is managed by Cipro, has been managed by Cipro all these years, and it is managed right now by CIPCO, which is the New Companies Commission. We don't necessarily have problems in that area because the database that we're using in that area is comparable to the database internationally. It's linked to various databases that we do searches on and all of that. So we've not had any problems in that area, but we do not want to be complacent. Because I think with any system, if it's an IT system, I think the key thing is to ensure that you maintain it, you upgrade it, you ensure that the security features are always intact. So I think that is one thing that we'll ensure and try to also emphasize in the commission that they always look at. So far, I can just guarantee that we've not had problems in that area. And so the IK database part is going to be a subset in that database, in the IP register that we have. So it will be a sub of that. So we'll use the same database. And I think just linking it to the issue around the cost, again, the cost of maintaining the database as one of the things that will be required here is going to be non-existent because that cost is already covered. So there's no additional cost. It just becomes a subset in that process. And then just in regards to the issue around the contracts and obviously communities not being able to negotiate properly, I think this is a problem that exists even currently with people that are even very well versed with the law itself. They still get themselves into contracts that do not operate in their favor at all. And I think that talks to the power balance, really. Because when the negotiations start, you start negotiating at a level where you don't have much leverage. So, which is why in the proposed bill, we've put as one of the functions for the National Council to actually assist in the contract. But also, the Companies Commission will be in a position to assist in that, because that's one of their functions as well, to do that. But I think one of the things that might be useful, and perhaps if this committee also agrees to that, is the minister could actually even issue guidelines. A guideline could come in the form of a template. We did that in the Consumer Protection Act. We also did that where we're saying that there are certain clauses that a contract with a consumer should never have. So the clauses that are really detrimental to a consumer, in the legislation, we've sort of outlined what is it that a consumer contract should not have at all. So that's one of the ways that we can actually do it. We can either do it through the regulations, or the committee could actually suggest other provisions that could enrich that, in the sense that it can actually protect people when they're negotiating, so that a contract that has a clause that relates, for instance, to a person forfeiting their rights, maybe after 10 years to the very same company, that could be a no-go clause. That a contract that has a clause like that will be considered to be null and void. That clause will be considered null and void. So it is one of the ways that we can look at, but I think we have not gone into that detail. We're only looking at the functions of the council, the commission, as well as the minister's powers to issue guidelines that could actually direct in terms of how things can be done. But if we want to elevate it, we can actually, the committee could look at elevating that part. The other question that I just wanted to deal with quickly is the issue around the tagging, and I think the chair's questions and Honourable Nyambi's questions are really related, because whether the House of Traditional Leaders comes into this or doesn't, for us really, when we come to Parliament, we come to process the proposals that we have in front of us. The advice that has been given is that the tagging is correct, and the various opinions that have been issued. But I think this is an issue that can still be discussed further to see the extent of the need for that. But Chair, I just want to assure you that the fact that it doesn't go to those houses does not mean that we have not looked at the issues of consulting with those various structures. We have done that process, and we'll continue to do that as well. And also in the bill, you'll see that the in terms of the appointment of council, of the national council, and so forth, the consultation with those structures is embedded in the legislation, so that it doesn't mean that because the bill doesn't go there, therefore the structures are not taken into account. Because I think at the end of the day, it's the interest of the communities that we need to serve. And I think the is going to be something that we perhaps might need to iron out earlier on, so that we, when we come to this committee, then there is no confusion on our part in terms of, you know, how we're going to proceed going forward. And in regards to the regulatory impact assessment, we have not, I'm not sure, Saros, did we forward the okay. Right. I think if you look at the regulatory impact assessment report, you'll see that we have looked at each and every structure that is going to be created by this legislation. While we cannot give the exact figures of how much they're going to cost, we've given estimates based on the similar structures that are operating. And in areas where, for instance, we cannot determine the cost, we've indicated why we cannot determine the cost, because either there's no data for us to work with, but we would give some estimates, again, by using comparisons. But what you look at, I think the conclusion really in the regulatory impact assessment is that overall, the cost of implementing this legislation or this amendment, it's far less than the cost that is lost by communities if this protection is not there. So if you look at that, that's how we look at it. What is it going to cost? So the cost, you look at it from the cost of what government is going to spend in terms of these structures. And then you'll see that in terms of, for instance, the trust is going to be sustainable, self-sustainable going forward. And we've got good examples of sustainable organizations. At this point right now, as we speak, the Companies Commission, the Companies and IP Commission, we do not fund that entity. That entity makes a lot of revenue through filing fees and so forth. Just last year, we had a rollover of about 500 million, over 500 million. That money that it generates, apart from the money that it spends, it generates that money and spends that money. So we've never had to bail it out for anything. So, and if you look at some of the structures that we're talking about, the trust will be sustainable, self-sustainable. If you compare that trust with the, because it will function also as a collecting society, if you compare it with the existing collecting societies like SAMRO, look at how much SAMRO is making. SAMRO only uses 20% of what it collects for its own operation. It uses 20% of that, and that is more than enough, basically, to sustain it. So we do not think that the cost really would be a prohibitory thing to implement this piece of legislation. So I think that's where we want to end it, but I think we cannot play down the importance of education and awareness. I think that's why we're saying that it's going to be something that we'll have to put more effort on. As we speak right now, Chair, the concern is that intellectual property law on its own is already something that is very far from the people. It's something that not even a lot of universities are offering it, let alone schools. So people would never know about it if they're not educated about it. So for people to be in a position to exercise these rights, we'll have to educate them. So maybe we'll need to take a different approach, the approach that we took when the Constitution came into this country. You know, those drives to educate people to know these rights, I think the similar type of approach needs to be adopted. But that's something that in legislation we can cater for, but it's the implementation part that we need to be concerned about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we've heard what we wanted to hear. And it will assist us members that we even only go back to our provinces. We'll do a lot of research. Now there is this indigenous knowledge about how it can be prevented and protected and so on, so that when it comes to us, we are really in a position to lift these things up from our provinces. And so that when we engage with the department, just after the 20th of September, we are well informed. Thanks very much, members, and I hope the visitors were assisted by the presentation. Honorable Adams, there are visitors from the UK, from the US, Italy, and Australia. I thought the visitor from Australia was from China. South Korea. South Korea, but it's stationed in Australia, so there could be some of those things. But thanks very much to all the visitors. I'm sure if you want to see after the session, you want to ask something, you want to add something, departmental officials are there. And if there's one thing that you want to share with a member, any member, I'm sure they'll spare a minute or two. But enjoy your stay once more in South Africa. Take business cards from members. They'll advise you where to visit South Africa, and they are prepared to host you. Thanks very much. The meeting stays adjourned. And feel free to have some more South African water, and juice, and whatever.